Welcome to our Sunday edition of Atlanta's Morning News. I'm Scott Slade, here each weekday morning with the information you need to start your workday. And on Sundays, we put aside this special hour so we can go in-depth on issues and stories important to Metro Atlanta. This past week, benchmarks in campaign 2022, especially among the major contenders for governor of Georgia. Both Democrat Stacey Abrams and Republican incumbent Brian Kemp releasing their economic plans that range from new programs from Abrams and more rebates from Kemp. Today, I want to drill down into one of the issues that will be discussed widely for the next 80-some-odd days before the election, expanding Medicaid coverage in Georgia.
But I've got a plan. It's a plan that's been more than a decade in the making. It's called Medicaid expansion, and it is time.
Stacey Abrams has advocated expanding Medicaid coverage under the Affordable Care Act for years. That was at an event this past March, and just this past week, she doubled down on taking $1 billion from the state's surplus to finance Medicaid expansion, something governors, including Nathan Deal and Brian Kemp, have resisted. Let's bring in a third-party expert to talk about this, a journalist who's covered health news in Georgia for decades. Andy Miller is currently the senior editor for Kaiser Health News and founder of Georgia Health News. What do we mean when we say expanding Medicaid now?
Well, the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare, Scott, set up an option for states to extend coverage basically to people who are living in poverty. And typically these are single adults who may be working part-time, whatever. And 38 states have gone ahead and done it. And what is meant for those states is it's cut down on their uninsurance rates. So hospitals and doctors get paid under Medicaid rates to care for those folks. And Georgia is one of the 12 states that has not taken that step. And Nathan Deal, as governor, was pretty adamant against it, as has been Brian Kemp.
In the beginning, Nathan Deal, as I understand it, Andy, was worried not so much about the initial cost because the federal government was basically going to pay the states to do it, but the payout down the line, he was afraid, would be massive. Are we still looking at that kind of thing?
Well, there's actually better incentives now for Georgia and the other 11 states to do this because the Biden administration has said, look, if you do this, we're going to give you an extra federal match in terms of overall Medicaid funding. And so Georgia would actually gain money for the first couple of years. It was estimated something like $700 million by the Kaiser Family Foundation. So it really, now the incentive is more on the side of it's going to be a good deal. And there were some sentiments by Republicans, including Governor Deal, that look, we're going to be on the hook here later on. But I note that the 38 states, several of which are run by Republicans, are fine with what they did, and they're not going backwards. They're fully adopted Medicaid expansion, and there's no thought to get rid of it.
We hear all kinds of numbers about who this might benefit if it does take place. We're talking about Medicaid expansion in Georgia. Is it tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people who might be getting medical insurance of a sort who don't have it now? What's the number?
Well, I've seen estimates anywhere from 400,000 to 600,000 Georgians who, again, these are low-income folks, working poor. It might be a single mom who can't work full-time. These are the numbers. We don't have an exact handle, but we know it's in that ballpark. It's a lot of people.
And as far as the authority to do this, see if my memory is correct on this, Andy. The Georgia legislature, at the request of Governor Deal back in the day, actually passed a law that says it's no longer up to the governor. The legislature has to pass on that. Is that still the bottom line here?
That's correct. Now, if Abrams does win, and she's clearly on the side of Medicaid expansion, if she does win, she would have to work with the legislature in order to get its approval. Now, we're told that behind the scenes, many Republicans, particularly those who represent rural districts are in areas where hospitals are really struggling, rural hospitals. And those hospitals uniformly, unanimously would say that Medicaid expansion would help their bottom lines. And so there's always been a thought that many Republicans kind of behind the scenes would agree to Medicaid expansion if it was possible to do. Mm-hmm. But yes, the legislature would have to decide this.
Will there be enough health care providers to take care of all these people if they start showing up with coverage?
That's an interesting question, Scott. I would say that, let's look at Grady, okay? They see a lot of these uninsured folks. They would absolutely be supportive of this because it would help them in terms of getting payment for uninsured patients. But on the other hand, rural areas, if it saves a hospital or two, that will keep medical care in that community. But we do have a problem separate from this or maybe related to this in terms of having enough doctors and nurses and other healthcare professionals in rural areas. And the state's taking some steps to kind of address those gaps, but we have a ways to go.
Yeah.
The other thing I would say is Governor Kemp has proposed to the feds, not Medicaid expansion, but his work requirement waiver plus his private insurance website waiver, and the feds have not agreed to either one of them. And so the Kemp folks said, look, if we do our Medicaid waiver, we'll add 50,000 uninsured people and give them insurance. But the issue there is a matter of degree. If Medicaid expansion covers 500,000 and the Kemp waiver program, which passed the General Assembly and was approved by the Trump administration, that wouldn't get to as many people, clearly, as Medicaid expansion would.
Andy Miller has covered health news in Georgia for many years. He's now senior editor of Kaiser Health News and founder of Georgia Health News. We did get a statement from the Kemp campaign on expanding Medicaid. Here's what it says. Unfortunately, the Biden administration is playing politics with Georgia's two health care waivers, Georgia Pathways and Access, and blocking these two programs, which would make health care accessible for the first time to thousands in our state and affordable for millions more. While Biden, Abrams, and the Democrats demand that we force Georgians to remain in a broken system under government-run health care, Governor Kemp and Republicans of the General Assembly will keep fighting to implement these waivers and find innovative Georgia-centric ways to lower cost and expand access. That's from Tate Mitchell from Brian Kemp, 2022. This is Atlanta's Morning News Sunday Edition. I'm Scott Slade. And while we're talking health news this morning, this past week, Georgia emerges as among the top five states with the most cases of monkeypox in the U.S. Georgians have a lot of questions about how the virus is spread and just who should be concerned. Here's WSB health reporter Sabrina Cupid.
I waited on the results, and it was positive. I had monkeypox.
Camille Seaton was the first woman in Georgia to contract monkeypox. While anyone can get the virus, Dr. Sherry Drinzik says
the vast majority of monkeypox cases that we're seeing both in Georgia and in the U.S. and even globally are concentrated among men who have sex with men or others who have intimate contact with men who have sex with men.
She says getting the virus requires prolonged skin-to-skin contact with the rash to become infected.
It's not via, surfaces. It's not via, what we call fomite, inanimate objects that people have touched.
The state health department urges those at high risk to get the vaccine, but vaccines can be hard to come by, as you've heard here on WSB.
6 o'clock Tuesday night, DeKalb County opened online appointments for monkeypox vaccinations.
Just a little over an hour and 30 minutes. All of them had been taken.
Dr. Drinzik says she's hopeful more vaccines are in the pipeline.
The beginning weeks can look a little limited in regards to vaccine, and then more and more come. And, we are able to, again, provide vaccine to all, not just the highest risk population.
She says at this point they are seeing very clear patterns of transmission for monkeypox and very clear populations at risk.
Individuals that fall into these categories of risk should indeed be vaccinated and should indeed, again, practice measures to try to reduce their risk in any way possible.
Sabrina Cupid, 95.5 WSB.
As we like to do in our Sunday Atlanta's Morning News, let's dig deeper into Sabrina's source interview with Dr. Drenzik. Just how communicable is monkeypox?
So when we're hearing about ways that monkeypox is theoretically possible to be transmitted, what I'd like to highlight is that even though it might be possible and rarely, it is not probable. It's not probable based on direct data and information that we have from all of these monkeypox cases and how, again, they were exposed and how they acquired their infections. When we are aware of a monkeypox case, just like we did with many of our other communicable diseases, you know, we go into an extensive case investigation and contact tracing, and this shows us and points us in the direction to say, well, this is how these individuals were potentially exposed, and they were not exposed, you know, in very casual ways by touching surfaces or dealing with clothing or bedding in a very, very casual way.
Dr. Sherry Drenzik with the Georgia Department of Public Health. Coming up next, how Atlanta will become the center of the PGA Tour in the next 2 weeks. Stay with us. This is Atlanta's Morning News Sunday Edition. I'm Scott Slade. Just 2 weeks from today, the golf world will focus on Atlanta with the final round of the Tour Championship at East Lake Golf Club. Alex Urban is executive director of the Tour Championship. There's a big difference this year. One of the biggest changes is moving the dates to the end of August. How would that help fans this year?
Yeah, that's I would say that's probably the single thing that we're really the most excited about is being able to wrap the tournament up, kind of put a cap and exclamation point, if you will, on the PGA Tour season before Labor Day, before college football, you know, gets going with that big opening weekend that they always have. And we've got so many fans, myself included, that are golf fans and college football fans. And I think this is going to be great for all those folks that were in the past, maybe had to choose between the two. And now we took that choice away from them. So we're going to be wrapped up that week before Labor Day. Very excited about that.
Alex, speak to the legacy of benefiting the community by the Tour Championship and how that's going to move forward this year.
Yeah, that's something that here at the tournament we take very seriously, you know, our role, and it's something we're really proud of in working to better the community where we play this tournament here in East Lake. And I'd say that that's mostly underscored by the relationship with the East Lake Foundation. You know, since 1998, the tournament has given more than $42 million to various charities, but most notably the East Lake Foundation. And that's it's contributed to a number of projects over the years, like the building of Drew Charter School and what they've been able to accomplish there with the graduation rates at 100% and everyone's going to college. And it's really helping to turn this area and improve this area over the last 20, 25 years. So that's one piece of it. I'd say one of the things that helps tell the story of the philanthropic nature of the tournament is our Hope Tee Shot on Thursday. And that's something that's grown over the years into this great tradition where, you know, two first tee kids, one boy, one girl, hit the ceremonial first tee shot in the tournament. And it's something they're not just handed that. They have to do an essay contest and an interview portion and a golf playing tournament to identify these two kids. And now there's a scholarship component too. So it's something that really highlights the importance of that philanthropic arm of the tournament and something we're really proud of.
Well, listen, one more thing here. Let's bring fans up to date on how they can attend. What's the story on tickets?
Yeah, so the good news is there's still tickets available at tourchampionship.com. Nice and easy. You can always follow us at Playoff Finale on Instagram and Twitter as well, or find us on Facebook at Tour Championship. But yeah, so we've got grounds tickets, which, you know, a grounds ticket experience is a lot different than it used to be. There are fan areas all over the golf course, you know, food trucks, local fare, activities for kids. We've got the Georgia Aquarium coming out here. But there's a whole lot of things to do with that ground ticket. So I don't want to undersell that as a ticket option. But we do have some upgraded availability as well in our Michelob Ultra Club, as well as a few other hospitality for sale, all of which you can find on tourchampionship.com.
Listen, I really appreciate you making it easy. And there's so many great things that happen around the Tour Championship. Alex Urban is the executive director. Thanks again for making this such a wonderful premier event for Atlanta, and good luck.
Oh, thank you, sir.
Coming up next, our Sunday roundtable, we'll break down the dueling economic plans in the campaign for Georgia governor. Stay with us. Atlanta's Morning News Sunday edition continues, and it's time for our Sunday roundtable. Joining us is WSB political analyst Bill Crane from CSI Crane. You can see his weekly vlog and blog at WSBRadio.com. And Atlanta Journal Constitution political reporter Greg Bluestein. Follow his Politically Georgia podcast on AJC.com. And you ought to read Greg's book, Flipped: How Georgia Turned Purple. Hey, guys, it's good to be with you again. Hi.
Good morning.
Happy Sunday.
Well, let's dig in. Greg Bluestein here this past week, a momentous chapter or two in the race for Georgia governor. We're finally getting some economic plans from the two major candidates. Stacey Abrams and Brian Kemp seems to be centering on returning part of the budget surplus to Georgia voters. What stands out to you?
Well, Scott, they have vastly different plans for how to dip into the state's record surplus, more than $5 billion of cash to return to voters in different ways. Stacey Abrams talks about a $1 billion tax refund, but also spending the money to expand Medicaid, to lengthen the state's suspension of the state gas tax. And also she wants to legalize casino gambling to extend and expand the Hope Scholarship to add a needs-based component and allow students with a C average rather than a B average to apply for the scholarship as well. So she has a very, very broad plan. Governor Kemp says, hey, my plan is going to be more narrow. We don't have money in our budget to do any long term. We can do one-time quick hits. And so his idea is $1 billion tax refund, which is still big, and $1 billion homeowner rebate. So he says, look, we just don't have this sort of long-term spending in this. The surplus is great, but we don't have a long-term way to add new government programs that we can sustain in the long-term future.
And Greg, just looking at the numbers here, if you average everything out, that's going to be on the Kemp plan, that'll be around $1,000 if you look at both rebates back to the typical Georgia taxpayer?
Yes. And Stacey Abrams' plan would be several hundred dollars depending on your income levels, but also folks who make a certain amount of money would not be eligible for this. So she's targeting people who are middle income and lower income rather than folks who she says, that her campaign assistant, she says, don't need it as much.
Gosh, an eligibility clap. Bill Crane, how does this strike you?
Well, it's sort of like the quote that came from House Speaker David Ralston on this week. Elections have consequences and leadership matters. We are in the position we are in Georgia, in part because we've had conservative leadership who's been fiscally responsible, both in terms of generating economic activity and on the spending side. So whereas several of the programs Stacey Abrams proposed are merit-worthy, things like expanding Hope Scholarship to needs-based giving and additional programs that are not funded by Hope Now, technical schools and junior colleges, to a broader cross-section of the population, those have to be paid for later. And for example, if we have I would support a constitutional referendum on expanding gaming and bringing sports betting to Georgia. I have for years. But from the time that passes, and I think it would, to implementation and having casinos up and running and up sports betting is years plus the time to the referendum. Even if she would be elected in January of 2023, that referendum would occur in 2024. So that revenue wouldn't be here until 2025. And we need to be mindful of that. This is a state, not a federal government. We're required to have a balanced budget. So Governor Kemp is correct. This is one-time money, partly because of the boon of all the federal largesse still floating around from pandemic aid. But $5 billion is almost twice the largest rainy day fund any governor in Georgia has ever had to experience, and it's a good thing. But some of that money should be tucked away for rainy days, and we're going to have them. It looks like we may see the recession that everybody's been talking about looming, and when job cuts start and when income start pay cuts start, all of that pulls back on the state's income. So we are not likely to see a $5 billion surplus next year. And as the governor also pointed out, and Stacey Abrams has advocated, leaving the gas tax cut in place, giving Georgia the lowest gas taxes in the nation. That's 29 cents a gallon every day and about $150 million a month. So far, having spent about somewhere close to $700 million on giving Georgians that temporary pause in the collection of those fees, that has to come back eventually. So those dollars are now coming out of that surplus as well, to the tune of about $150 a month, and we've been doing it since spring.
Bill, of all the campaigns that you've advised in the past year, well, one of the keys is make proposals that stand out with the voters. Is there enough delineation here between the two plans, between Kemp and Abrams, that either one will get credit here?
Well, on economic policies, typically the Republican in this and other states tend to have the stronger hand. And also in this case, you've got the incumbent governor who can point to record employment, record low unemployment, record recovery coming out of the pandemic, new job growth off of the charts, corporate relocations like the two electric vehicle plants, one down on the Savannah coast, one coming in East Georgia and Stanton Springs about an hour east of Atlanta. All of those things are tangible and you can see them. Ms. Abrams did serve ably in the General Assembly, but she doesn't have a track record of packages of things she can point to other than her own successful near election in 2020 and generating record voter registration. Mm-hmm. So I think on the economic front, it's a little harder for voters to kind of know what she's saying is doable than it is on the Republican side. Conversely, when she talks about health care expansion or abortion and reproductive rights or what she might try to do with gun control as governor, even with a Republican legislature, I think she wins the day. So it depends on which voter you're talking about as to which proposals stand out more.
Fascinating. Greg, anything further on that, especially in light of the AJC polling where Georgia voters are just by a mile say that inflation and rising cost are most important to them when they vote this fall?
Yeah, you know, they far overshadowed abortion and narrowly defeated in that sense concerns about guns.
Yeah.
But, you know, inflation, high energy prices, the economic instability, the uncertainty that voters are facing right now are clearly top of mind of these candidates as well. And they just have very different views of how to tackle that, right? Governor Kemp, he blames the Biden-Abrams recession and he points to a stronger state economy with low jobless rates and economic development numbers that have set another record this year. So he says, look, you know, we need to do what we can in Georgia to fight the 40-year high inflation, in his view. Stacey Abrams, she has a different longer-term strategy that involves taking a step that very few leading politicians have embraced, and that is legalizing casino gambling and sports betting. It's something that, you know, we've heard Democrats and Republicans steer clear from in the not so distant past, but she believes it's a way to raise a tremendous amount of new revenue to sustain long-term programs without hiking taxes.
Greg, we had healthcare journalist Andy Miller, who's widely respected in Georgia, has been reporting on healthcare for many years on earlier today. Just talking about the ins and outs of potential Medicaid expansion. And he said things have changed since Georgia said no several years ago, and that quite possibly could be more financially feasible here for Georgia and the 11 other states that have decided not to go along. Is there any traction for this issue at all?
Yeah, this has been a longstanding opposition from Republican leaders in Georgia, really for most of the last decade. There is some traction from rank-and-file Republicans, state lawmakers, local leaders who have said, you know what, Indiana expanded it, other Republican-led states have expanded it, their healthcare systems are growing, more people are getting treated. But here in Georgia, it's become something of a third rail for at least Republican leaders to embrace. Do I think if Governor Kemp is reelected, there's a push, you know, behind the scenes to expand Medicaid? Probably in a second term, but it's not something he has embraced whatsoever right now. And Stacey Abrams made that really the centerpiece of her campaign, especially the first few months where every question she was asked seemed to pivot back to expanding Medicaid.
Yeah. And Bill, some rural Georgia lawmakers could very well point, if this winds up being financially feasible, Medicaid expansion could save a bunch of rural hospitals.
It could, and that's probably in about 60 or 70 counties, the majority of the patient load are Medicare or Medicaid. But the Affordable Care Act of 2010 called for, at the end of 2020, the states would start spending and paying for those expansions to health care of Medicare and Medicaid at that time, 90%, 80%, or starting at 10% and phasing up to 100% over time. Those costs haven't been transferred yet. Eventually, that cost has to come home. We cannot, as a nation, and I'm talking about federal government spending now, continue running trillion-dollar deficits and expect, with this softening view of the nation's economy and the softening view of America's credibility in the world, expect to retain our status as the reserve currency of the world. So at some point, Washington, Republican and Democratic Party leaders need to get more responsible about spending. And when they write stuff into legislation like costs going back to the states, that at some point has to be implemented. So those states that are holding out, including Georgia, do have a valid point. At some day, at some point in time, those costs come home.
Let's move on to some of the other campaigns here with 80-some-odd days until the general election. Greg, the debate picture may be coming into clearer focus. Yes, we will have a governor's debate, but what about U.S. Senate?
Yeah, we'll have multiple governor's debates, one on WSB right here in these airwaves, and one that's on the Atlanta Press Club. We know that Senator Raphael Warnock has agreed to a trio of debates all over the state. But what we still don't know is whether Herschel Walker will accept any of those three. He has pushed out, he has promoted a fourth debate in Savannah, one that Raphael Warnock was not on his initial list. And it really what it comes down to is, A, how badly Senator Warnock wants to get on the debate stage. Will he accept this other debate down in Savannah? And B, whether Herschel Walker would even do it, even if Raphael Warnock accepts it, because we've seen him continue to move the goalposts on whether or not he'd accept the debate.
Hey, Bill Crane, it's tough to have a debate when only one shows up, right?
Yeah, I've run campaigns and been in campaigns where one candidate is afraid of the other or realizes they're not going to come across well on debate stage and try to minimize those opportunities. It doesn't typically impact either way the core voters of both candidates. It's, again, the swing independent voters and particularly suburbanites in metro Atlanta that end up deciding this, because they will place some measure of import on whether or not someone's willing to face their opponent and get in front of the public and take questions. So, and I question the strategy, but I also do understand why the Walker campaign in particular is not relishing the opportunity to be on the debate stage with a pastor who's extremely good at speaking and has, you know, demonstrated his debate prowess in Senate debates previously. But I think it's about 17% of the population that will vote that this will impact.
Oh, that's an interesting figure. Why that number?
That's where the undecideds are in most of those statewide races, and it's dropping. The undecideds were in the double digits in June, and they're dropping down into single digits. So I expect we'll see a pop-up again in the Libertarian numbers, which in most of the statewide races are 3 to 8%. Those generally vanish when the real voting happens, and they break for the Republican or the Democrat. So I'm adding the Libertarian vote and the last two statewide votes I've seen, and that puts you in the 15 to 17% range of voters who haven't already made their minds up yet.
Greg Bluestein, looking ahead to the next week, things are not slowing down, are they?
Things are not slowing down, and the ground games are stepping up. This is when the candidates really start to show that their ground operations, all these things that are being painstakingly built behind the scenes, the door knockers, phone callers, the text messengers, all those really are starting to come into play here as early voting. I hate to say it, but early voting is nearing. We're almost getting to that crunch time. And the candidates are also expected to really step up their efforts on the campaign trail. We're going to see a lot more of Senator Warnock, especially on the campaign trail, as his business in the Senate, you know, as Senate nears a recess.
Bill Crane, final words to you.
A lot of transportation infrastructure investment coming to Atlanta, and it doesn't get as much attention because we are in an election cycle, but they're going to spend almost $1 billion expanding Concourse D, and maybe as high as $1.2 to $1.4 billion. We may remember that all of Runway 5 came in under $1 billion, not even 15 years ago, and the entire airport was built back in the 80s for less than $1 billion. MARTA announced this week a major expansion and renovation and upgrade of the Five Point Station, which will bring a lot of high-speed transit and bus options that don't exist now, starting out of that Five Points hub. And additional expansion coming that are announced in individual projects coming off of that half penny sales tax that MARTA pushed through in Clayton and other counties, ranging from a bullet express bus or train down from downtown into the Cascade Road area to the Clifton Corridor. All of those things are being announced, and I think they're kind of just not getting a lot of attention because we're in the middle of an election year.
Bill Crane, Greg Bluestein, always enjoy. Thank you so much. Have a great week.
Take care.
You too.
We'll be right back. One more thing in our Sunday edition of Atlanta's Morning News. By the end of last week, the national price of a gallon of regular gasoline finally dipped below $4 a gallon. Have you wondered if it'd be cheaper to own and operate a new electric vehicle? WSB's Bill Caiaccio speaks to the AAA's Garrett Townsend about a study they've just conducted that answers that question.
This is a very interesting report out today on the annual cost of new car ownership, now above $10,000. Explain that.
Yeah, that's correct. You know, everything is getting more expensive this year, and that includes owning and operating a new vehicle. You know, according to AAA's 2022 Your Driving Cost Report, the average yearly cost to own and operate a vehicle in 2022 is nearly $11,000, or close to $900 per month in payments.
So what's behind this?
Well, not surprisingly, fuel prices are the most significant factor pushing this year's average annual price tag.
But there are several other factors as well, too, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that report factors in fuel, maintenance, repairs, tire costs, insurance. All of those factors are sort of put together, and then we can calculate the average cost. But fuel is the biggest factor, but certainly those other tires, maintenance, all of those things certainly affect the average price going up this year.
And so I also, in reading the report, it talks about what this has meant as far as people buying electric vehicles.
Well, you know, when you look at an electric vehicle, an owner is going to spend about 4 cents a mile to charge their vehicle at home, while the owner of a gas-powered vehicle is going to spend about 18.4 cents per mile to gas up. So when you look at one compared to the other, there's probably about a difference of $2,100 annually that a person purchasing an electric vehicle is going to save. Only about 3% of the vehicles that were sold last year were electric. So we've got a long way to go as far as balancing this out.
Thanks to WSB's Bill Caiaccio for speaking to the AAA's Garrett Townsend. And thank you for joining us for our Sunday edition of Atlanta's Morning News. I'm Scott Slate. We'll talk to you again tomorrow morning at 95.5 WSB.